Hello, and welcome to the podcast. Baroness Beban Kidron, OBE, is one of the country's foremost drama and documentary directors. Her long list of credits includes Storyville, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, Victoria and Abdul, and Bridget Jones, The Edge of Reason. Beban now sits as a crossbench peer and founder of the Five Rights Foundation. And for the past 5 years, she's been one of the most instrumental figures in ensuring better protection for children through the passage of measures such as the Online Safety Bill. I was in the audience at a lecture she gave recently, hosted by the Voice of the Listener and Viewer Organisation, and it sent shivers down my spine. Which is why I'm so pleased to interview her about it for the podcast, and also check whether she has any more directorial ambitions. Just before we start, Beban Kidron, you'll know, of course, that the fourth of Bridget Jones' films are coming up. You directed the second. Do you fancy doing the fourth?
No. I've absolutely hung up my director's hat. I didn't intend to, but once I worked out that there was a generational injustice going on in the tech world, I never made another film. But I am very close friends with the producer, and I'm not going to give you any spoiler alerts, but I do know what's in it.
Oh, how irritating. Sorry. I mean, just before we leave this, did you really enjoy it? Because I think, you know, I've never done a feature film. I did documentaries, whatever, of which I had an element of control. I always think the moment you start as a director on a feature film, it's a process of retreat. You have the vision of what you want to do, and then you're running out of time. That doesn't turn up, whatever. And it is just a war of attrition till you're through, and then you can take a breath. Is it as difficult as that?
Well, I think what you've actually described, if you think about it, is politics and filmmaking. It's a war of attrition, except in politics, you very rarely get to take a breath at the end. I actually absolutely love being a director. And I think that the bit that people miss from the outside, yes, it rains when you want sunshine and you run out of time and things thwart. But I think the bit people miss is you are surrounded by 150 people of great skill, immense creativity, and they are all taking a huge breath to get behind you, to get what you want in the day over the line. And I don't think there is anything as sort of exhilarating as working on a project with, you know, with a group of people for the same outcome. And they create a sort of a magic carpet for you. And that is a beautiful thing. So I think that some of the problems of making a huge film are very similar to my life now. But you don't quite get the magic carpet that is the creative industries.
Yeah, but that's okay. I mean, that sounds very impressive. But the fact is you go on set and everybody looks at you and nothing basically happens till you say so. It's that the first day. Isn't that terrifying?
No, of course it's terrifying. And I actually remember, because I actually trained as a camera woman first before I actually decided to be a director. And I do remember my very first day directing anything and thinking, oh, you know, the designer's going to fiddle with the curtains and the camera person's got the lighting and the, you know, and the grip's got the track laying. What am I supposed to do? And then someone said to me, do you want a yellow bag or a blue bag? And from that moment on, people didn't stop asking me questions. And I realized what you are there to do is walk forward, answer the questions, and be certain about what good looks like. And that was the job of the director. So I loved it. You can't get me to say otherwise, but I am very, very happy in my new life.
Right, you just explained why I could never make a feature film director. Thank you for agreeing to this interview. I want to base it upon the lecture you gave to the Voice of the Listener and Viewer. And if any of our listeners actually want to read that in detail, they can go to the VLV website, and there it is, both in video but in speech. And at the end of that speech, you said this: we have two jobs. One is to insist that democracy runs technology and not the reverse. That is the job of lawmakers and the electorate. And the other is to hold up a mirror to the world. You're addressing this specifically to the broadcasters in the audience. I wanted to pick up the second first, which is whether it's getting so much more difficult to do that. I mean, you picked out Mr. Bates and the Post Office, saying it defied this move towards algorithmically determined commissioning. Do you think that algorithmically determined commissioning is infecting our public service broadcasters?
Well, I mean, inevitably, there is the sort of, you know, the gold rush for attention, you know, and we see that not only in the obvious places like social media and so on, but we also see it in some of the streamers who kind of go, oh, you like this, so you might like that. And they're basing it on your previous viewing. So what it is an inevitable road towards similarity rather than the somewhat old-fashioned idea of PSB broadcasting, which is you have a little bit of everything. So you see everything in relation to everything else. And part of the process of that is seeing yourself in relation to everyone else. And it's interesting that we're speaking today because, in fact, today is the second reading in the House of Lords of the media bill. And one of the big issues about the media bill is prominence. And, you know, there will be a debate later about how do you find public service broadcasting? And I think the fact that people are so exercised about how you find it speaks to the problem that the algorithm is not throwing it up.
You mean if those who control the platforms put, you know, PBS at 595th or something and put themselves at the first, the chance of anybody finding the PBS station is virtually nil?
It is. And, you know, you and I are speaking as a generation who sort of probably looked at the Radio Times and saw what was on tonight. Well, now we're talking about people walking into their living rooms and going, send me some comedy. Yeah, I want to have a laugh. What's on?
But why does that matter so much? Some people would say, well, actually, we've got more choice. Well, you've heard the free marketeers say there's more choice than ever before. Why does it public service matter? Why does it matter that we, as it were, at least at some point, come to together and see some of the same things?
Well, I think actually we know this sort of instinctively as well as intellectually, which is, you know, a shared human experience is something very special. So anybody listening now, think about the last time they went to the theatre, the last time they went to the cinema, a concert, a football match, a school play, you know, that sort of togetherness, that shared experience actually has some important sort of personal feelings, as in it creates a particular kind of memory. It creates a shared memory. So, you know, as we all get adult, someone else can remind us where we were. But more importantly, it allows for some shared values and shared understandings.
And challenging, do you think? Because, I mean, we speak at a time when challenges of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, and most people don't actually know what the words mean. We haven't had a debate about the words, what the words mean. And most people will not have shared or understood the experiences gone through by Jews and Palestinians and people and Muslims and so on, unless there is a place where they can find out about the experiences of those outside of themselves and about outside of their, as it were, niche. It's going to be very difficult for society to hold together and have intelligent conversations, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I think there's, I mean, I think actually that example raises more than one issue. I mean, first of all, listening to other views and having places in which consensus at best, sympathy, empathy, at worst. But I think you've also raised the question of what is a collective truth? What is a common truth? And I think that we've got ourselves into a pickle where everything that everybody asserts has become their own truth. And a lot of my lecture was around the question of synthetic material and the idea of algorithmically AI-derived truths.
What you're delivering, essentially, people believe they have their own truth, their own, as they would say, lived experience. And what it pays people to do is to feed them what they believe, whether what they believe is true or not. We can see that in the States, obviously, with the Murdoch organization over the opinion polls, over Trump losing the election or whatever. It's too expensive for Fox, for example, to ram home the point that actually Trump did lose the election, because if they do that, the revenues go down. So you're saying that market-led models essentially deliver what people want, even if what they want is not the truth.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I think I don't have the statistics top of mind, but, you know, it is just merely a fact that mis and disinformation is viewed and clicked on several times more than the boring old truth. Because actually, if you relieve yourself of the duty of either truth, complexity, nuance, you know, balance, any of these things that have been traditional in the PSB thing, if you relieve yourself of that duty, and you can say whatever you like, the chances are it'll be rather more flamboyant. And so one of the things that is driving this is a lot of extremity is rewarded literally by viewing or by monetization.
So in the attempt to get attention, you are driven to extreme expressions. Now, you might modify them slightly, you might. But it's the extremity of your expression of or what you do visually that gets the audience's attention in this world in which everybody... Can I just bring you back to broadcasting briefly before we move on and look at something that you praised, which obviously and so many people do, about Mr. Bates and the Post Office. On the one hand, one could say, isn't it extraordinary, despite all the excellent journalism done by a whole range of Radio 4 Panorama, a whole range of people, it took that drama to really bring it home to people. But the other thing you could say is that that drama, I'm told, for example, cost about $8 million. ITV could only put up $4 million. And it could only do that, and therefore depending on co-producers. And it could only do that partly because it's now, as Channel 4 is, suffering dramatically in terms of advertising revenue. I mean, the figures are, I don't know what they are. Some people say it's 15% of ad revenue down. And these big tech companies are siphoning off advertising on the basis that they can say to buyers, media buyers, we can target much more effectively than the broadcasters do because we have all this information we've got already. We know what they want. We can deliver. Are we watching something, do you think, of an existential threat to public service broadcasters funded by advertising?
Yeah, I mean, I think my short answer is yes. And I think that there is a sort of question that I have, which is, you know, that Channel 4 was sort of born out of an idea of market contribution to PSB. I wonder, you know, whether that model was ever going to last in the long term. And I would probably argue for much greater public investment in the national broadcaster and in PSB more generally from the public purse, because for the very reason that what we hold precious, whether it is children's programming, drama of a local sort for a local audience, science, arts, you know, even religious programming, you know, I would argue that those things are better in collective hands, and that they, if we put them at the mercy of market forces, there will always be seen through the prism of a cop show, a reality show, a game show, a something that is more like clickbait and less like PSB. And so I just think we have to be prepared to pay for some of this material. And
well, the writing is there, isn't it, on the wall, for example, in journalism. If you look in the United States, what's just happened with Vice News and elsewhere, it's carnage. Newspapers, even New York Times, whole range of newspapers that we'd have respected in the past, cutting journalists, cutting stuff in a quite dramatic. And you could say, oh, well, let's just say, you know, this happens, you know, other forms will come forward. It doesn't quite look like it. And you said in your VLV speech, we are once again allowed, those who own the means of production, to avoid responsibility for what they enable. And you said, we are again allowing tech companies to scrape our data, build powerful systems with no corresponding societal responsibility. Well, if that is true, a lot of people would say, yeah, but what do you do about it? Now, in a moment, I want to come on specifically with the child abuse issues you're concerned about it. But more generally here, you seem to be saying, well, one thing we can do is sustain public service broadcasters by investing in them. Is there anything else we can do?
Well, yeah, I mean, listen, the thing is that some of the things that we should do we have not done, and it becomes increasingly difficult to do. I mean, one of the things that we've done is let the concept, the ideological concept, both in America and here increasingly, of freedom of speech to mean that the person speaking has all the balancing power and the people listening have none, you know, and the people who are silenced by speech have none. So, you know, I mean, a really sort of straightforward example, and I speak to you from Parliament, is, you know, how many women are being kicked out of public life by the violent misogyny? I mean, we're not talking about, you know, a wolf whistle from a, you know, from a scaffold. We're talking about, I know where you live and I'm going to rape you and murder your children just because they're women. And it's disproportionate.
And whereas before they would not have been heard except in the pub and they might have had a kick for that, now they have the means of distribution of this right in front of them in the room, whichever room they're in.
No, exactly. And so my question is the freedom of speech absolutely going to be untrammeled? Yeah. Are the people who broadcast this, and I am using that word very deliberately, they are broadcasting it entirely without responsibility in this picture? Or are we going to actually start saying to the tech companies, not only, my dears, must you pay your tax so we can actually fix the holes in the road and pay for the NHS, but more importantly still than you paying your tax is actually we want you to broadcast to our broadcast rules.
But if it was the case that all of these people were based in this country and we could deal with them under our systems of taxation and whatever, fine, but as you know well, they're virtually out of anybody's political control.
Well, on that point, I'm going to disagree with you, because they are in our country. They're making profits in our country. They're operating in our country. And we do have the means. We just don't take it.
What means then? What could we do? What could Parliament now do?
So first of all, I don't want to get too in the weeds, but, you know, they actually benefit from our IP laws. They benefit from earning money. We could actually put a tax on them if every time something goes from an online provider, we could actually do a sort of a rates tax for operating in the UK. We do that in certain ways, and we do actually engage with them. And as you know, both in terms of our data law, our safety law, IP law and so on, we have engagements with all these companies. Of course we do. What the companies then go is, okay, we'll move out of the UK. And there is a political fear of that fact. So I think it's wrong to say we don't have any purchase. It's right to say we don't maximise our political purchase on these companies.
Do you think politicians are scared? Scared in a personal sense, not in terms of their safety, sort of, but in terms of what the big broadcasters could do about them? It used to be the case that our big worry was about people like Rupert Murdoch, who seemed to go to Downing Street, whichever prime minister was in power, and have an extraordinary number of meetings, and presumably he doesn't waste his time. So there must have been some deals being done. Do you think that that now has got greater, and that politicians are worried a wider field about the power of some of these international companies?
I mean, undoubtedly. I mean, I have said on the record a couple of times, you know, the tech companies go in and out of the White House and in and out of Downing Street like they got a cat flap, you know. And in fact, when I started on this journey 11 years ago, I was treated like a middle-aged woman who didn't understand the new rock and roll. I am actually quite pleased to say that a lot of people have actually, you know, have joined me in saying, actually, you know, this is bad for democracy, it's bad for children, it's bad for the mental health of the nation, indeed the world, and it's really bad for all sorts of industries, and it has sort of bizarre impacts. And I think if you look at the, not just broadcast, and it's not the technology, it's the governance of the technology. I mean, and I give you sort of one example about, you know, when Airbnb exploded on the scene, I went, this is going to have a long-term effect on our housing stock for young people in the future. And everyone thought I was a tech naysayer. Well, I'm not a tech naysayer. I'm just saying, you know, in making every room in the country in a hotspot very, very super valuable, all the money, all the value got sucked up towards Airbnb. And what you're left with is local people who cannot get houses. So there is a problem overall about the model is so often not the technology itself, but the governance of that technology. And if from the beginning, people who did, you know, use Airbnb to supplement their income and so on had been part of the tax system, if Airbnb had been part of the tax system, so on and so on, maybe we could have had some public housing. I am not suggesting that we don't have technology. I am suggesting that we make technology play by the rules of our specific democracy.
Now, you're the founder and the chair of the Five Rights Foundation, which aims to build, as you say, the digital world children and young people deserve. What was the, what is it? What are the five rights? And what was the moment, the trigger for you in setting up the organization? Perhaps the second question first, which is, what made you want to set this up? You became a mother, you're a mother of two children yourself. Was that a, was there a moment connected with them? What was it?
No, it wasn't my own children, actually. Earlier in my life, I set up a charity that used film to educate children. And so I always had a lot to do with children in their teen years. And in 2012, when the smartphone became the price point that an adult would give it to a child, I realized that all the kids around me suddenly changed. They went quiet and restless. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And I was a filmmaker at the time, and I made a documentary. It was called In Real Life, and it was about teenagers and the internet. And in the course of making that film, and I literally spent hundreds of hours with children in their bedrooms, gaming and gambling, and I'm afraid watching porn and falling in love and all the different things that children do online, good, bad, and ugly. I also went on this journey of interviewing a lot of people who were credited with creating the internet. And one of them said to me, one of these sort of founder voices said to me, it was the utopian vision of the internet that all users would be equal. And when he said that, I had one of those kind of like realizations. I thought, well, you know, that sounds okay, except if you treat a child as if they are an adult, then you're not treating them as a child. And a child is a child until they mature. They're not a child just until they reach for the smartphone.
Yeah, in a way, it's way like, of course, I'm very ancient now, but it's rather like you open a pornography shop outside a school and you say to children, you don't have to buy, but if you want it, here it is. We have taken the pornography shop, if you like, or the top shelf and whatever, and actually moved the top shelf into every child's home, potentially, haven't we?
And their nursery and their playground. But it's not only about material, it's also about the addictive quality, the demand on their attention, the notifying them through the night, the training them to respond immediately to every buzz and thing. You know, there are a lot of developmental challenges with dealing with this very, very sort of demanding, addictive, toxic environment, and some of the things that we were talking about earlier in terms of how binary a lot of the discourse is, and putting kids and really young kids in the middle of that. And some of the work that we're doing right now is actually concentrating on early years. And what we're finding is the development cost of a high use of technology between 0 and 6 is absolutely catastrophic. So it's not just about porn for teenagers. It's a whole journey in which they were not considering children as having development needs or indeed rights.
But is this something where you think it is possible to have a conversation with the digital companies and they will work with you to try and deal with these issues? Or is it something where you think actually, and certainly in the shorter term, governments have to intervene? I mean, and we hear all these stories, for example, about stopping phones going into schools, for example. Well, yeah, and the second phone tucked in somebody's, you know, underpants, whatever that they said, and dealing with all those issues. I mean, in the while you assess this evidence, which is deeply disturbing and raise the concerns, are there specific issues or are there things in the short term that you would like to see governments do?
So I'd like to answer your question by saying absolutely not by talking to them and absolutely by making interventions. And I say that not because I don't talk to them, but it's only when you're making the intervention that you can have a decent conversation. And I'll give you a really good example, which is I remember one of my very earliest conversations with the head of trust and safety or whatever they're called in Facebook. And I said, do you not understand how dangerous direct messaging is for young people? And I explained that what was happening was that young people were being encouraged to make their network as wide as possible. And so when people contacted them, they were just adding them. And those people very often were adults that they didn't know that they shouldn't be in direct contact with, and they shouldn't reveal their whole life to. And they went, you know, well, they can switch it off if they like. Yeah. Cut to a few years later when I introduced here in the UK something called the Age Appropriate Design Code. And in that particular case, their response was to cut off direct messaging. And now in the online safety bill, every online company that deals with children will have to stop direct messaging for under 18s. My point is, when I told them about it, they were disinterested. And when we had the regulation, they started to do it. And now we have a law, everyone will have to do it. Now we can talk about what good looks like. You can't talk about what good looks like while they're making money out of being bad.
I'd love to continue, Vivanne Kidron. I know you have to go and discuss the media bill, but if anybody wants to listen to your ideas in more detail, they can obviously go to the VLV website, get the lecture. But also, if they want to find out more about the Five Rights Foundation, how do they do that?
It has a website and it has a Twitter feed. And please join our newsletter as well on the website.
One final thing. Do you ever despair? I mean, you're just going and going and going, but there must be mornings where you think, oh, no, I can't. I mean, do you ever have those moments where you think it's an impossible task?
I would be lying to say I never have those moments. But, you know, I actually ultimately do think that most people want 80% of more or less the same thing. I think we all disagree about the last 20%, and I'm really happy to live in a world of 80% good. And I urge people who listen to your show to actually just tell their politicians this is an issue that matters to them.
Baroness Beban-Kidron, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Baroness Beban-Kidron. And remember, all our paid members will receive the podcast almost a week in advance. So if you want to hear it first and receive my weekly blog, please sign up now to patreon.com/BeWatch. It's only £1.99 per month. You can also find the link in the description of this programme. And that's it for this week. As you know, this podcast is presented by me, Roger Bolton, and it's produced by Kate Dixon. The sound is by Dave Kitto, and special thanks to Quinn Genty. It's a Good Egg production. Until next time, goodbye.